This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. Welcome back. And today we have a politics-packed episode talking about the new Trump administration and specifically focusing on the new cabinet picks and zooming out a little bit to think about what happened at the inauguration and what it portends for the next 4 years. So today, I'm thrilled to say that we are joined by Michelle Shen. She is a breaking news writer on the politics team at CNN, where she writes articles and contributes to live coverage of the most significant political stories of the day. Michelle, I'm so happy that you're here. Thank you for passing judgment with us.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So let's start with something you've had a front row seat to the last few days, and that's the confirmation hearings. Let's start just with which confirmation hearings have you been covering? And then I'd love to dive into each of them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's been quite a few. I was just up on the Hill yesterday and kind of bounced between a few different hearings. I was listening to Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s hearing as the Health and Human Services Secretary nominee, also Tulsi Gabbard as Director of National Intelligence. And then on top of that, the Elise Stefanik's hearing as well. So it's been a really packed day.
So you really have seen many of the highest visibility confirmation hearings. Let's start with RFK Jr. I think people know who he is. They know the Kennedy family. And there's been a real break with the Kennedy family and RFK Jr. Could you just talk a little bit about his background and the schism that we see between RFK Jr. and the Kennedy family and why?
Yeah, definitely. So RFK Jr. has sort of a storied career as an environmental lawyer, and he had done a lot of, you know, really interesting and good work to help communities that were like impacted by environmental inequities or environmental racism. And I think a lot of the controversy that stems from his nomination is around his view, you know, in the last few years about vaccines. And he has been spreading a lot of lies about vaccines and their ties to autism, which, you know, has been scientifically proven not to be true. And I think, you know, he also obviously decided to run as an independent candidate and sort of broke away and then made amends with Trump. And, you know, his family has been such a stalwart in the Democratic Party. And I think to many of them, it's been really difficult to see him sort of breaking away from the party and spreading a lot of these really harmful lies that do impact the lives and health of a lot of children across America and across the world. And so, you know, what we've seen from the Kennedy family in particular was like earlier on in the campaign, you know, when Biden was still running, they endorsed him. Many of them called like Biden like their personal hero. And then they also condemned RFK Jr. and sort of aired a lot of his dirty laundry in terms of his past sort of drug abuse and a lot of just the difficulties they've had with him as a family member and some of the lies that he spread. And so it's definitely been interesting to see sort of the Kennedy family kick out one of their own.
Take us inside the confirmation hearings, if you would. You correctly noted what I've also seen, which is the biggest point of contention is that he seems to promote views that don't have scientific grounding, let's say, when it comes to vaccines. Although it sounds to me like maybe he was trying to distance himself from previous comments. Could you talk to us a little bit about how those hearings went? Specifically, did he get any pushback from Republican senators, except for, I think there's one Republican senator who questioned him who's a physician. Maybe that was slightly different. And Let's start with the Republican questioning.
Yeah, definitely. I think the senator that you're mentioning is probably Bill Cassidy.
And yes.
Yeah, I mean, he is part of the Senate Help Committee. He was a doctor and he, you know, has had a lot of experiences as a doctor that have shaped his worldview and his view on public health. And so I think a nominee like RFK Jr. is one that I think is a bit difficult to swallow, right? And I think to RFK Jr.'s credit, he really did say in the hearing, like, I believe in vaccines. I believe in the polio vaccine. Like, I think that children should be vaccinated. But, you know, he also didn't go so far to distance himself from certain conspiracy theories around vaccines and their ties to autism. And I think that with a lot of Republicans, especially like ones like Cassidy, who have a background as a doctor, this can be something that is really difficult to take. And obviously, Democrats on their side grilled him a lot about the statements that he's made in the past. I think specifically regarding the polio vaccine, that mm-hmm. was perhaps an entreaty to Mitch McConnell, who obviously, despite not being majority leader anymore, still exercises significant influence within the Republican conference. And McConnell himself was struck with polio, and it's something that he's lived with his entire life. There's been times where he's like fallen or tripped, and that has made big news. There's always been questions around his health since he's had such a long tenure in the Senate. And so I think to him, it's also something that's like deeply personal. Like, if you've been affected by maybe like vaccine hesitancy or skepticism, or maybe like, you know, if you hadn't really had the benefit of experiencing the life-saving experience of like having vaccines, this is something that is deeply personal. And it's hard to say if RFK Jr. will get confirmed or not, but I do think that there is some level of resistance to him, even from Republicans.
Well, and this, of course, used to be an issue, and this meaning vaccines and vaccine safety, that really didn't divide us on partisan lines the way it seems to now. So you started to answer my last question, which is, how is this looking for RFK Jr.? Obviously, he's a very high profile nominee. I think of all of the cabinet picks, people can think of, oh, RFK Jr., and they think of some of the more controversial things that he said. Of course, during the presidential election, he himself was running, tried to meet with Kamala Harris. She said no, offered to meet with Donald Trump. And it sounds like during that meeting, if you read the tea leaves, there was an offer of, you can be in my cabinet if you support me, essentially. So I'm wondering, I mean, the Senate obviously very closely divided. Can we look ahead and guess what RFK Jr.'s political fortunes might look like?
Yeah, it's hard to predict. I would say that much of the Republican conference is largely very heavily influenced by Trump, right? And I think the only candidate so far that, you know, has really faced massive political consequences is Matt Gaetz. You know, as you know, he was nominated as attorney general, and basically there was so much backlash against him, and he was really, really so hated across the Republican conference. And of course, there had been a lot of questions about his ethics and claims that he had been involved with sexual misconduct and drug use. You know, there was a variety of things that sort of pushed him away. I would say that RFK Jr. doesn't quite inspire that level of hatred. Like, he hasn't had this like long history of making enemies within Congress. He wasn't responsible for like pushing out a speaker of the House. So I think RFK Jr. has a better chance. And I think that Trump will exercise his political will to get his nominees across the finish line. And we definitely saw that with Pete Hegseth, who was another controversial nominee. I would also say, like, RFK Jr.'s views on vaccines, while they have been scientifically disproven, doesn't mean that they're not kind of mainstream among a lot of Trump voters. So one interesting thing I think about being in the room in the hearing is you can see like all the different besides the journalists, right? Like all the different random people that just like came to this hearing who were really passionate about this issue. And so like I had seen people who were like doctors and medical professionals who went into that hearing and, you know, wore pins that said like vaccines do not create autism and stop spreading like fake science. Like we're members of the medical community. We know what we're talking about. I saw those same people in like the hallways of this Senate office arguing with people who were vaccine skeptics and, you know, spoke about their experience with their children and with vaccines and what they believed and like how they felt about vaccine hesitancy. And, you know, I saw really, really heated arguments break out between these groups of people in the hallway. And I think it was interesting to see because that is really this broader culture war very much on display. And I think it's something that Trump tapped into.
It is. I mean, it's interesting to think about our feelings and views about RFK Jr. are so wrapped up, I think, in the prism with which we see so many things in 2025. I mean, you have, as you mentioned, the Senate Republicans being heavily behind President Trump and his picks. You have this question of whether or not he's qualified, whether or not some of his views are, in the view of some people, dangerous to put him in that position. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens. I want to move on to another high-profile cabinet picks and also somebody who herself ran for president. So moving on from RFK Jr. to Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard for the Director of National Intelligence. Now, Michelle, my understanding is that at one point, Tulsi Gabbard was actually put on a watch list. I think a lot of people may have heard that headline, but could you talk to us a little bit more about who she is and her background that may be concerning to some?
Yeah, definitely. And I think Tulsi Gabbard is sort of a baffling pick in many ways. So she was once a Democrat, she ran to be the Democratic presidential nominee. But, you know, she has since left the Democratic Party. But a core part of Tulsi Gabbard is that she has always been really anti-war. And she's a veteran. And I think to some degree that has resonated with people. I think what is controversial about her is that she's sort of been anti-war to the degree where she has been, I would say, sympathetic to many dictators across the world. I mean, there had been many concerns about some of the comments that she'd made about Russia and about being involved in Ukraine. But then also, you know, she has been really outspoken in her sympathy towards dictators like Bashar al-Assad. You know, obviously he is no longer in charge of Syria anymore, but he was involved in a series of really, really devastating human rights abuses. He used chemical weapons against his own people. Like he has, you know, thrown his political dissidents in jail. And the fact that she had visited Assad, met with him, and questioned a lot of reports about some of the human rights abuses that he had made was pretty concerning to a lot of people. And I think it's made a lot of both Democrats and Republicans question whether she would be the best pick to handle the intelligence community.
Do we know why? I mean, we do know why, but can you tell us a little bit about why President Trump decided to pick Tulsi Gabbard, given that you've laid out publicly available facts about things that she said regarding world leaders, and there's reasons that there are concerns about her? What has President Trump said in her defense?
Yeah, definitely. What we see in common with a lot of these nominees, and even if they're very different from each other, like I'm thinking like a foil to Tulsi Gabbard is like Marco Rubio, who's had this incredible, you know, tenure in intelligence and is widely respected. Like he's picked a lot of people across the spectrum. But the one thing that really ties all these people together is that they're extremely loyal to Trump and they're not really willing to question him, right? And I think by putting all these conflicting people within his cabinet, like he really can exercise a lot of power. And I will say, like, I think a big part of Trump's appeal is that he's going to like shake up the government. And Tulsi Gabbard is someone who's unconventional. And she also really went out on a limb on like the campaign trail to support him. I went to a Moms for Liberty event where she spoke, and she obviously spoke really highly of Trump and was extremely critical of Democrats. And I think she sort of taps into that anti-wokeness attitude. Like, I remember a lot of her speech talking about how, her parents, her dad in particular, was in public office as well. And she had talked about how Democrats had, you know, shouted insults at her and her family because of the things that they campaigned on and believed in. And I think while a lot of the criticism that's been levied against her is very valid, I think she's sort of turned that into this anger against sort of the wokeness of the Democratic Party, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense, because I think people, you know, hear comments that she's made and they ask why President Trump put her forward for this position. And that's really helpful in helping us to clarify what makes her an appealing pick for the president. And I think that that theme probably brings us to our next nominee, Elise Stefanik, who, in my understanding, really has transformed herself in many ways from being a moderate Republican to being somebody who has fully embraced President Trump and his policies. And I'm hoping you can talk to us a little bit about her confirmation hearings. My sense, and again, being nominated for a position at the UN, the UN ambassador, is that hers are less controversial. Is that correct? Is she having a easier go of it than RFK Jr. or Tulsi Gabbard?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that Elise Stefanik has been a part of the Republican conference a long time. I mean, a lot of her views don't really ruffle the feathers of the Republican conference as much as RFK Jr. and Tulsi Gabbard. You know, Tulsi Gabbard, particularly like with her views on like Russia and Syria, like there's a lot of defense hawks that still exist in the Senate. And I think to them, like, you know, her views on Edward Snowden, they're just so controversial. Whereas like with someone like Elise Stefanik, it's totally different. I mean, her crusades have largely been around anti-Semitism on college campuses, or she's been a big part of just bringing more like women into politics and things like that. So I don't think she's quite as controversial. But like you said, she's had just a massive shift from when she started as a representative. And she has definitely changed a lot and put herself much more in line with Donald Trump.
Well, that brings us, I think, to our conclusion of the cabinet picks. Is there anybody else right now that you're looking to, that you're going to attend their confirmation hearings, that you think we should be keyed into? Obviously, there are so many picks that are important. I mean, we increasingly see that who's in charge of all of these agencies, who's in the cabinet. Of course, those are Senate confirmable positions, that it really matters in terms of the direction of the government, and therefore oftentimes their impact on our daily lives.
A few other people that I would point out that I think, I mean, this hearing already happened, but like Kash Patel as FBI director, I think is another really interesting pick. He has sort of said that he wants to tear apart the department and it's been weaponized politically. And so I think to sort of see, you know, how he does in that process. I think another interesting person is Russell Vought as the director of the Office of Management and Budget. Like, I mean, it's not necessarily as interesting to think about like management and budget, but like those things are really, really important. And those are the things that affect the daily lives of Americans, right? And you really saw that with just the federal pause on a variety of different programs, and how that impacted children, veterans, and the elderly. These are nominees that are going to play a really big role on who gets access to what in America.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, all we have to do is look to the proposed federal funding freeze, and then the fact that it was temporarily stopped in court, and then the Trump administration themselves decided to push pause on the pause to see how important people in these positions really are, how much power they wield. Let's talk about Kash Patel for one moment. I read some reporting of what was happening in the confirmation hearings. And Michelle, you as a reporter, as a member of the media, I wanted to ask you about one, I think, controversial part of his confirmation hearings where he was questioned, I believe it was by Senator Adam Schiff, about statements he's made that he thinks that essentially people who, maybe you want to describe this in a way that's better than I can, both members of the press and members of the public who were, for lack of a better way of describing it, maybe staunch political opponents of the president would face civil suits and potentially criminal prosecution. I'm being very vague on purpose because I want you to fill in the blank, but can you tell us a little bit about Kash Patel's previous statements and how those came up in the confirmation hearing?
Yeah, definitely. I think that Kash Patel has sort of become this attack dog by Trump's side, where like any of Trump's political enemies, you know, whether they be journalists or activists, I think what he's meant to do is just instill this sense of fear, right? That like if you are a political opponent, then you are like in danger of, you know, facing some sort of like legal action. I mean, and you've seen Trump has been involved in a variety of like lawsuits against various media companies. I will say, like, to people who are worried, like, I still do really think that we live in a democratic society with a free press. You know, obviously, I am worried a lot about my role as a journalist and like how safe it is. I receive a ton of hate mail all the time, and I've had some like pretty awful things said to me. And I think that has existed a long time. And since Trump has really sowed a lot of distrust and hatred against the media. But I will say, like, I still feel safe and confident and very supported in what I do. And I guess even with him like making these comments, I am still really confident in the role that the media plays in our democracy and in preserving it. And I think that's going to continue. I will say, like, the response against Trump by like the public has been a lot more muted this time around. But I think as more of his policies take shape, I'm hoping people will pay attention and get involved.
Well, I just want to say, I'm sorry you've gone through that. I certainly have had my share of less than the supportive feedback, let's say, and I'm expecting that you have received more than your fair share of that. So that actually brings me to my next question, which is, you covered Biden. Now you're covering Trump. Obviously, this administration is only a few weeks, a few days old. But how is it different just from your perspective as somebody who writes reports for CNN on breaking news, a lot of political stories, a lot of really important stories? I think people have a general sense, obviously, that they're very different presidents, that they are very different people, that they have very different goals. But many of us are not in your shoes. So can you give us your perspective on how has your work changed? How has your life changed?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that with Trump, he definitely has a different way of speaking and a different way of addressing different issues. And so I think what's been really important is with everything that he says, with everything that, say, his new press secretary, Carolyn Leavitt, says, like, we have to be extremely careful and detailed in how we contextualize things, how we provide facts. You know, a lot of times there are things that he will say where we're like, we don't have any really backing or data around this. Like, I think we really sort of take a beat when we write, you know, like we had been writing stories about like immigration or about his transgender ban on the military. And a lot of the things that are said by various people aren't necessarily backed by fact. And so I think what we have to do is like be extremely careful with like what we choose to write and what we choose to include. And then when we do include those quotes, we like contextualize it and provide the proper info so that people can really get a sense of the issue. So, it's challenging. It's exhausting. Like, Trump just has this very intense schedule. Like, since the start, he's released a lot of executive orders, and it's been hard to keep up with, but it's a challenge. But I think I've had a lot of support. And I think what I really respect about my newsroom is that people are so, so careful about what they put out. And like, really, it does go through like multiple different layers of checks and balances until something is published.
And I think that's a helpful reminder for all of us, because we do depend on you to help educate us and let us know what's happening. And as you said, the response to the second Trump administration is different than it is to the first, but people certainly still need to know what's happening in their government, because this is a government that represents us and it's a government that's designed to be responsive to us. And I'm hoping we can end with the very beginning of the Trump administration, and that's the inauguration. I know you covered the inauguration. We got to talk a little bit before we started recording about what you noted about the inauguration. You know, people obviously heard President Trump reiterate a number of promises that he made on the campaign trail. I don't know that his vision of America and those policy promises was remarkably different than things we've previously heard on the campaign trail, but I thought you had some really insightful observations about the inauguration.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it was fascinating to cover that whole, not only the inaugural address, but the inaugural weekend, because I really think it was a case of the have and have nots, right? There were a lot of people who came to DC to see his inaugural address, right? And to sort of be part of that moment in history. But, you know, given that it was moved indoors and there was such limited access, like what you really saw were a lot of people who, you know, a lot of Trump supporters, especially who came into town hoping to see him. But really, in reality, the only people who did have intimate access to Trump were a series of like billionaires. And I think what really shocked me from watching the inaugural address was just to see the people that were sitting right behind Trump, like just right behind his family on the dais among potential future members of his cabinet. Like, you saw Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Tim Cook, just a series of these different billionaires. And it portends something sort of deeper in his administration about who is going to get access to him, like who is going to have his ear. Like, is it really going to be those supporters who were in the freezing cold that whole weekend and just, you know, wandering about DC? Or is it going to be these people who were inside the room sitting right behind his family and among his cabinet? So even being in DC that weekend and like just seeing these like glittering inaugural balls that were like black tie with all these people dressed up, and then just seeing all of these supporters like squeezed into, you know, these various bars, it just really gave me this sense of who would get access to him in his administration and who he was really looking to serve. And I think that was just sort of interesting to see on a visual level.
Well, it certainly is going to be interesting for all of us to follow what's going to happen in the next 4 years. President Trump has promised big, bold changes, and he has certainly made good on that. If you just see the breadth and depth of the executive orders that have come from the Oval Office in even the first 24 hours of the administration. So, Michelle Shen, we will certainly be following your reporting. I hope you will come back and talk to us about more big political stories as you continue to have a first row seat to history and to cover them.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.